Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mdiwa Gabaza, and for today, we are going to be talking a little bit about, small businesses. We're going to be talking a little bit about the economy. We're going to be talking a little bit about the world of sustainability and just getting a sense of what's going on in that space, with a mover and a shaker who's looking to make a mark in that space, and that is Sandi Sosibisi, who is founder and director over at Kui Studio. And we're just going to understand, what's happening in that business. Sandy, greetings to you today.
Good morning.
So we are at Kui Studio's office in Johannesburg. Firstly, on the name, right? For people that are listening, Kui is spelled COOI and then Studios, right? Is that an acronym? What is this?
It's an acronym. So I picked it up from my former life at Accenture. I was the head of open innovation for the Africa geography. So I was particularly passionate with that space, which is about just connecting large enterprises, corporates with startups.
Yeah.
And so when I started my business, I thought I'd purely focus on that, but it's not like that anymore. So we've evolved, but it stands for Co-Open Innovation Studios.
Okay.
And the co means collaborate, connect. It's basically bringing two bodies or more together.
All right. What's the elevator pitch on Kui Studios?
So we are a tech design company, so primarily designing bespoke human-centric solutions for large corporates, particularly in the B2B space.
What does that mean? Because all the words that you've just said say consulting to me. Is it consulting?
Yes, it's consulting. So we get clients who give us work that's more on cutting edge technology. So we primarily focus on the emerging tech space, or generative AI, metaverse, etc. And we use our human design, human centricity capability on focusing on the end user and consumers to then build the products accordingly. So typically when you find an app that is not being adopted by people, it's because they've forgotten to do the step that we focus on, which is human centricity. So we focus a lot on interviewing people, following people, understanding people, then building products that people adore and love. So we help financial services companies because they're focused on building products that people adopt, highly competitive market. So everyone's trying to get everyone to use their app, to use their product, etc., but also leveraging that same expertise of human centricity to solve for social problems. So we look at things like the miner experience, how we can improve the day in the life of a miner, from waking up at 3 a.m. in the morning to get to work to getting home at 9 p.m. How do we make that life much better, more comfortable? What technologies can people with no digital literacy actually use in the mining space and other sectors as well? So we've got a big a human focus in the technology that we design. And then we've obviously got a technology division that takes the human-centric work we've done and converts that into a product. And primarily B2B space, because we help corporates build their solutions for either their employees or their customers. And so that's why we focus on the B2B space in terms of the solutions that we build.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, the problem you're solving is that just because there's a great piece of technology out there doesn't necessarily mean that technology is going to translate in the market, especially if you haven't taken the step to actually adapt it to how people are actually living and working out there. Yeah. What makes ChatGPT great was because it was accessible,
yes.
Right?
Yes. So, South Africa by and large is a black population. So a lot of the banks, mining companies, most people are building products for black people. And so I think the consulting space has been by and large owned, or the work that we do has been owned by another demographic. And so us coming in the market, I think we've changed the game completely. I think because majority of our business is young black people, we're building products for either our mothers or our grandfathers. So we focus primarily on bottom of the pyramid sort of market segments. And that's the market segment that everyone wants. If you look at the Capitec story, if you look at what Old Mutual is doing and all the other clients, they're all trying to attract those sorts of markets that are particularly like bottom of the pyramid. And so we are able to design products much better because we speak the people's language. We also just understand their day-to-day challenges because we have lived through them. And then maybe that's what sets us apart as a bespoke, human-centric tech design company.
You know what, I'm going to pose one or two problems to you. And I like the fact that this is what we're talking about. And I'm very keen to get your take on some of these things. One of the things that I spend a lot of time looking at is financial technology, you know, fintech businesses. And there's this huge war against cash and cash use. A couple of things that people talk about is that one of the reasons why cash is still prevalent is that merchants, you know, find it hard to justify digital payments below 50 Rand. Mm. And also at the same time, consumers in that space making purchases below 50 Rand, it's very hard to justify tapping, swiping, all of that stuff, either because of bank charges, you know, all of that. So with all of that context, right, why would you... Given your speciality, why would you suppose, because I don't know if it's an area you've even looked at, but why would you suppose that fintech companies haven't really broken through, let's say, with the taxi industry? Mm. Because one of the arguments that's made is if you really want to make a dent against cash use in South Africa, get the taxi industry on board with digital payments.
Mm. I think where we're struggling with the digital payments, over and above the underlying issues you've mentioned of bank charges, etc., I think the fintech sector is failing to paint the customer value proposition on that. So how does having a taxi person transition from cash payments to digital payments, how does that benefit them? And I think a lot of the times we don't do that groundwork. And I think there's a lot of value from moving that sector into cash, into being digital. I mean, you and I, we know that if we make more online purchases in a month, we get rewarded by that by our respective banks in terms of money. I mean, I know that I buy my electricity every month just out of e-bucks, you know, for example. So I think we're struggling to articulate why it's value for them. There's lots of values that I can think of just on the top of my head without even engaging a taxi owner. The safety element is one of the things. The fact that now he doesn't need to employ someone in the taxi to count the money as it is being exchanged, because the minute you sit in the front seat, you're like, you're employed, you know, to now calculate, etc. So there's that value, and him also not having to worry about organizing change, etc. I think there's lots of value in that. And I think we're just struggling to highlight that value for the taxi owners, because if it's going to benefit them, they will take it on. But if we're not demonstrating that, then you're going to get a bit of, resistance on that adoption.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Now, it's a very interesting, what you call the space, because I do see, especially as someone who covers technology, media, and telecoms, that there's so many solutions that people have that don't always translate, especially, like you said, bottom of the pyramid. There's a huge gold rush for that market, mm-hmm. but the translation, the making it matter to someone, why should someone care, doesn't always seem. And people are coming up with all types of stats. I think the last numbers that I saw, there was an estimate that, you know, that's a market you're looking at 650. Billion Rand, you know, worth of GDP, per year, that people are trying to go after. But then I guess translating, that market is something to think about. My question then is, you were at Accenture before this, and now you decide to do something of your own. What makes a person leave an established environment like that? I'm probably asking you a question that you've gotten many, many times, but just to understand what gives one, especially in this economy, what gives one the wherewithal to actually leave, but secondly, the confidence, right, that this is an area they can succeed in.
I would definitely be harsh on myself regards to the timing of my departure. It was like 7 months before a pandemic, so maybe not a good start. I started Kui Studios in 2019 May, and we know what happened thereafter. So maybe I would change the timing of it. But in terms of just like why it was time, I think both my parents are entrepreneurs. So I think it's in me to be one, but I guess I was scared, you know, when you have a corporate job, you have a stability of income, you've got a car, you have to have a bond to pay. So I think there was that fear of not being able to cover my expenses as such, which is valid. I think though, my role, I wanted to do more in the innovation space. You would know that Accenture does an array of consulting, you know, from strategy to technology. So I wanted to particularly focus on the innovation side. I think that was a part of the reason. I think it was just like time in many forms and shapes. I think I had done enough. I'd learned a lot. I think a lot of the skills I use today in my business and how I run the operations, it's all learnings from those 9 years at Accenture. And I think the time came for me to just like now jump out and you know, try this unknown business world. And I'm grateful for my time there, but I'm ever so grateful for just even jumping, because I think a lot of us have a desire to have an entrepreneurial journey, but because of, I guess, the anxiety and the concern around the financial stability, it is concerning. And I'm so grateful that I was able to leave at that time, because what I've built, the fact that I have like almost 15 employees that rely on me on a monthly basis to put food on the table, it's a big responsibility that I don't take lightly. But I'm also just grateful to contribute to the economy, because a lot of the people we employ is people that were previously struggled to get employment. So I think I'm doing something bigger than myself. I think I'm helping individuals find a space in the professional environment and do well and succeed and help me succeed at the same time. So yeah, so that's maybe the answer to why I left. It's all those reasons.
Because we're a finance platform, one of the things that we do need to ask about is on two points. Firstly, how have you gone about funding yourself? And in that, right, what types of funding avenues are available, you know, to a business like yours? Because there's this perennial discussion around how do you fund, you know, small businesses in South Africa. I attended, you know, a summit that you hosted, in August. You know, from the time that we're recording, it was last week. But one of the big things that people were talking about, and you even had the likes of Tumi, you know, coming on to talk about, you know, how do you go about funding, you know, yourselves? What have you found in that space?
So I think consulting funding is quite different, because it's not necessarily a technology product. You're selling skills of human beings, which makes the funding landscape a little bit different. I think, though, there's much to be said around me diversifying my business model, which I'm currently working on. So we've got a couple of technology solutions, and you could ask me more about them, that we've developed in-house that could be utilized. And so I would want to monetize those. It's just, I guess, the efforts and the funding to do that. And I think there I could probably look towards VC funding, because those are, I guess, products that can demonstrate exponential growth that VCs would be interested in, maybe not so much consult model. I think how I've done it is really about I used my savings. I cashed out my pension fund, the normal thing. And I used it to build the business, the studio in my own apartment. I then have been able to just identify corporates that wanted to support small businesses through grant funding primarily. Not big tickets, but just really just to help us buy laptops, to buy equipment, etc. And that sort of helped me as well. I think, you know, it's been by and large bootstrapping, I'd say. But in that bootstrapping, I've also learned about just like how important cash is. So I think if you have like somebody's going to give you like a 5 million rand, you know, check, you sort of don't necessarily suffer the cash flow burden that I faced. So I had a big, I mean, today you speak to me now, I've got a different story to tell, but if you spoke to me 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, I had major cash flow issues as a business. It's just born from the fact that I didn't know how to manage money. I didn't understand cash flow. I didn't understand how you need to watch cash flow. Yeah. And given that you are like a financial, focused publication, it's just how important that was for my business. And I wish somebody told me that. We get a lot of entrepreneurs coming to speak to us as you're building your business, but no one really tells you about the nuts and bolts of how you need to be intimate with your financial, with your books. And so what we typically do is as startups, as or new founders, we employ a small business accounting service provider, and we become so aloof to the finances of the business. We don't even understand how to like do a tax return, a basic one like EMP 201, which is for employees, or the VAT tax return. We completely outsource it. We don't know what money's coming in, going out, etc. You know, and so we just don't have good financial management. And so I learned the hard way of just going through a really difficult time in my business where I was borrowing money from friends just to pay payroll, etc. And I wish somebody had like told me about the importance of understanding the finances of your business. And today I do. And maybe it was a necessary evil, because now I'm very intimate with my business. but really, it's that. And if I do it all over again, maybe I would have actually gotten funding, so I don't have that cash flow management dip. Maybe I would have maybe just done a financial management course as well, as opposed to so solving for the problem before it even happens, as in when it happens. So, and many businesses today, die because they just don't have cash. And I think the cash flow issue is quite pertinent, and it must be given extra attention.
Huge extra attention. maybe just as a follow-up to that point about, managing cash flow and that type of thing. I have this, you know, long running thesis about people that come out of consulting and that they do well in business. I mean, we were talking about it just before, we started recording here. Consulting seems to give people like a really good basis upon which to do well, either in a corporate space or in a business space, from a strategy point of view, where to go, you know, all of that. Great frameworks, right? Mm-hmm. Where's the disconnect in terms of the managing finances, the finances part? And I ask that because even when you talk to accountants themselves, mm-hmm. right? Chartered accountants coming out of the biggest, you know, mm-hmm. firms, when it comes to either managing their own money or they get into business, they tend to have these working capital issues. And they're like, but you're an accountant.
Exactly. I think the lessons that I learned. So I never knew how important running sound operations was. And running sound operations has got a direct impact on your balance sheet. So having like procurement processes in place, you know, accounts receivable processes in place, making your organization have governance internally as well. And just the case study with Kui is that we probably made the least amount of money in the last financial year, but we're actually the most profitable. That's because we spend so much time just fixing into the house internally. And so, you know, we don't struggle with cash flow at this present moment because our internal processes have been fixed. I think with working with most of us that come from large corporates is that this when we're employed by these corporates, we don't do that work. It's given to an operations person or an accounting clerk or an accounting administrator. So you don't actually see that work. But what you see is the maybe the process, because you need to adhere to the process and you sort of know it. But the calculation of knowing when you're going to run out of cash or how to even recruit people is really the nuts and bolts of operation that you're not necessarily part of or know how to shape or that framework. And I think we in consulting, we talk to very much about how to sell, how to position, how to, you know, speak to a client, how to present yourself, professionalism, et cetera, all those things. But I think really the crux and the nuts and bolts of running the business, I think that's because it's spread across the whole corporate. I mean, in corporate, you've got someone whose job is just to manage remuneration and benefits. You've got somebody's job who's just to manage accounts receivable, someone who just manages accounts payable. Whereas in a startup, you have to sort of like, you have to manage all of that across the board. So you only have like the luxury of one financial person per person, if you like it, or the luxury of one HR person. So you must do recruitment, learning and development, you know, all of these things. So I think because the roles are pretty much spread out across, you don't get a proper view of the whole ship. And so you learn that when you become a startup founder. And yeah, as smart as you are, I think most founders go through that pain, because I don't think I signed up to be a people manager, but I guess that's what I do for a living. Yeah.
No, it's a very interesting space to be in. And I think, you know, from a reflective point of view, there's probably a lot to learn, you know, from a journey like yours. And I think that's where the value is in having these conversations, because lots of people want to start businesses. And I think we've almost romanticized the notion of starting a business, you know, especially in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Small businesses are the engine. What? And we're not denying any of that, right? But the nitty-gritties of what it actually takes to run, operate, and keep the business afloat, those things really need to be communicated, you know, in a better way. Now that we understand what the business looks like on the consulting side and what you've been facing there, when it comes to the solutions that you are creating in-house, right, how is that situation being managed? And what I'm asking is, when you create solutions, are these solutions that you have in-house and then you're sort of putting out to clients, or are these solutions that are being created on behalf of clients? Because your ability to make money off of them and how much you get to keep and all of it becomes completely different depending on that.
So I think we've got a few that can be adopted by clients, specifically in the climate change space. So looking at CO2 emission trackers, currently right now, most corporates, when they're reporting on ESG, it's more I want to say a thumbsuck exercise, but that probably is quite harsh. Yeah. So they use figures such as, you know, fuel consumption bill, how much fuel they bought. They use those figures to determine how much CO2 they emitted, which is not really true. But what we're trying to say is we want to have a combination of using procurement data, but also using actual data of having IoT devices in their factories, et cetera, that actually manage that actually accounts for the CO2 emission. Then you can compare, you know, your procurement data versus your actual data, and you should come to a closer calculation thereafter. So there's a couple of them are in that space around climate change, and we call that climate tech. I think there's a few that we've developed in-house because we're just a small business and we've got tech capabilities. So one of the ones is probably an illegal one. When we're a startup, you probably have one license for certain softwares, and then everyone in the organization sort of shares that license to sort of things. So what we have is a password manager, because you want to know at any given point who's got access to a specific system. And if somebody wants to request access, they request it, and then you're able to know who has access, and you're able to share passwords. Like I said, it probably is illegal. Yeah. But most startup founders need that sort of stuff, because you're obviously trying to watch your cash. You don't want to have 3 or 4 licenses when you can share a license across various team members, and so it's a password manager. So we've got a couple of those that have helped us write. I mean, this week we're launching our own internal HR platform, which is basically managing, once a person has been employed, it's them onboarding into the company, keeping their details, having all of their learning and development data available in one location, having other data points from HR being available, and therefore it's going to help us with the people aspects of our business. Like I said, I'm primarily in the consulting space, so I help people, and so it's quite important that I learn how to, you know, account and manage them and track and monitor, etc. And that's why this HR platform is quite important for our business.
Very keen to understand the rationale for developing some of these systems. Is that born out of a cost, you know, prerogative? And I ask that because in both spaces that you've just mentioned, people have already gone and made password managers. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that big consulting firms have entire systems dedicated to knowing and seeing what are people doing, what are they working on, you know, deliverables, where they are, all of, you know, that entire thing. I know in certain companies where you have consultants, there's literally an admin person who's dedicated to, you know, managing that one consultant's life. Then behind them is another layer of admin that's aggregating all of this stuff. So just keen to understand, you know, did you find it that it would just be cheaper? I've got the talent. Let's just make our own in-house tool to solve our problem.
So I'm very big on acquiring softwares to help solve for our day-to-day problems. But sometimes I find a lot of them are US born. Yeah. So sometimes they don't quite speak to South African context. So that's the first challenge. So I think from a requirements perspective, sometimes it doesn't do exactly what you're required to do. So if it's quick enough to flip, you know, and you've got the talent, why not? I think the HR platform is after trying a few platforms actually, that just didn't quite do what we required them to do, and you'd have to end up having a combination of like 3 different platforms to do it. And so you sort of want to have a great employee experience, and so that's why we're housing everything, and we're hoping that once we've settled our HR platform internally, because it's not like a solution where if we were to share it in the environment, like we'd lose money from it. It's an operational tool. We can probably make a couple of cents from that. We can then share it with other small business owners, because I'm sure business owners that are small struggle in SA with, you know, onboarding employees, et cetera, et cetera. So looking to really help. I'm very big on like the mistakes I've made or the troubles that I've had, like sharing that with other entrepreneurs so that they can, you know, not have to go through the same burden. I think when I started, I think my biggest complaint to the entrepreneurial sector is like, I don't think there's enough sharing of the hard things.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm trying to demystify.
Yeah. Lots of romanticizing, but not not enough, you know, sharing on the, what you call this, on the nitty gritties. Before we let you go, perhaps when it comes to your own business and where you're going, right? There's a couple of things that we're curious about. 2 things. Firstly, are you able to share with us, you know, maybe some of the big clients that you've been able to get, understanding, of course, that there may be sensitivities, so whatever you can share. And then second is to say, this is a business that you started, you know, pre-COVID. So we're looking at about a 5-year journey so far. We know the stats around, you know, starting a business and getting to 5 years. What does the next 5, what do you hope the next 5 years look like for you?
Sure. I can definitely share some of my client stories. Yeah. So we work with Telkom, helping them around innovation culture, etc., and just driving the innovation agenda. The same for Old Mutual. We help them on one of their programs, Siyakhula. So similarly, innovation culture, innovation agenda problem. Primarily helping, I guess, resources companies really around service design. So they're all developing services that are meant to enrich and help their businesses, especially internally, perform better, whether it be the mine experience, whether it be the procurement experience, helping resources companies, the likes of Sasol, Engine, also Anglo as well, that we help them on the human experience. I mentioned Standard Bank. We're helping them around with some data analytics work. So our tech division has got both software engineering, but also data analytics and predictive modeling. Looking to do some generative AI with some of the corporates we work with as well. So I guess in five years is done. So I can take a breather and say, yes, we're still alive. We're still breathing. Our lights are still on. I am a very determined person, and I believe I'm going to be very successful. So, if you just heard that a lot of the clients that I mentioned is primarily clients that are Fortune 2000 clients, you know, so those are clients with offices in London, offices, you know, in the States, all over the world, in Europe, etc. So we're very intentional about the clients that we try and attract. So it's Fortune 2000 companies. And that speaks to us understanding that our market in SA is quite small for what we do. We do very specific, bespoke sort of consulting. And so if you're looking to be a billionaire, you sort of need to solve the problem for a billion people.
Yes.
So and that's why it's important for us to grow outside of the South African geography. And so really looking to serve the same clients in other geographies, that be it South America in the mining space or even Australia in the mining space. In the banks, we know London is quite a big hotspot for a lot of the South African banks. And looking to really diversify our geographical reach. We've seen that happening already. A lot of UK companies are using local talents to work remotely and deliver. And so I think there's lots to be said about that space. So I think we're going to probably grow more geographically going forward. I think in terms of just our client base, I think the clients I've mentioned, I think probably have about 11 large globally listed companies on our books. So really looking to not necessarily grow a new client base, but rather just do more with the clients that we're currently serving and, yeah, grow in that space.
It's actually quite brilliant. The fact that you've been able to gain, all of that traction in the market and have, those clients on the books, because as much as we talk about funding, which we did earlier on, a big problem that business people face, which is the value of relationships and understanding corporate spaces, is just access to market, right? Because in a lot of cases, that's just where the wheels fall off. You know, how do you actually get into the market and, get in front of the right people and all of that? So the last point for us is, as someone who's helping to translate a lot of the big technology trends into usable, practical cases, right? Generative AI, cutting through the fluff. Fad or fundamental technology that will be with us for generations?
I think AI in general is something that people need to keep a close eye on. I've seen it in my business in terms of the technology we're adopting. I've seen it literally evading or removing a specific task from someone because there's an AI tool that does it for us. The South African economy is growing, but we're not, as much as it's not great growth, but it's growing. But the number of jobs is actually diminishing, which is really a proof point that, there's a lot of job replacement through technology, and we're seeing it in the market. So this conversation around AI is not taking away jobs, I think we need to double click on that. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think it is definitely removing a lot of tasks, and therefore people are cutting down their headcounts. We're seeing in the market. And I think with regards to generative AI, I think it's one that's going to really change the marketing space drastically. I think the production of content from photo, video, we've seen what it can do. And I think because we're all on a cost containment wave, I think it's definitely going to be tapped into. I know that we tap into it already. Like when we do our points of views, our reports, our fancy reports, we don't necessarily go and hire a photographer to capture all the footage. We just generate it in-house, etc. I think in terms of just writing up in content marketing, I think we're going to see a shift there. I think a lot of companies are going to employ generative AI to actually speak and be a mouthpiece for them. So I think it's, for me, I think in marketing, I think marketers need to really acclimatize themselves to this technology, because I think it definitely will shake it up a bit there. So definitely not a fad. I think it's going to be quite a game changer, and I'm excited about it, because it takes away so much of the, I want to say, mundane or tasks that I'd rather have somebody else do. So looking forward to AI and what it has to hold, and generative AI is here to stay. I don't think it's going to be a fad, like, because I think metaverse is taking quite a while to take up scale.
Yeah.
And I think that'll be the case so long as, because it's got quite a big hardware component to it. So long as high barriers to entry. So long as that's the case, I think metaverse will not readily be adopted. But I think because generative AI, you can even use it on your phone. I think it's something that people need to pay extra attention to, because it could really either replace them or enrich their roles. So depending on which side of the boat you're at.
All right. So that's where we end off. It has been great just chatting to Sandiso about what's going on, in her space, coming out of a big consulting firm to sort of start a more, I'm going to call it a more boutique, type of operation, with a consulting element to it, but also a solutioning, part of the business as well. So not only sitting and, helping to craft strategy for businesses, but also coming up with their own solutions, talking quite a bit about what's going on in the funding space and some of, her journey, having started a business so close to the COVID-19 pandemic, and then weathering that particular storm, and where she sees the business in the coming 5 years, focusing on those Fortune 2000 companies, and trying to make the most of the big clients that they have on their books. And also, one of the things that I like is people that stand on business, and she actually says that she believes that she's going to be very successful. And it's always great when you're talking to someone like that, because that's great determination. Also, understanding the realities in South Africa, what's actually going on, how do you take big technology trends or solutions that are out there and make them relevant for people. And it was great starting off the conversation talking about taxis and some of the ways in which perhaps the technologists in the economy have not translated some of the use cases, particularly around digital payments, into that industry, sort of as a macrocosm of some of the things that we're seeing in other areas of the economy, and some of the issues that Sandiso and her team are also then looking to fix with their own solutions, and ending off on the same theme, talking about AI, and that she believes that this is something that's here to stay, and that's something that people should continue to look out for. Sandiso, thank you so much for being with us today.
No, thank you so much for having me.
So that's it. We're talking to Sandiso. She is founder and director over at Kui Studios. And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, wherever you choose to get your pods casted. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So from myself and the rest of the team, it is a good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.